Okay, welcome everyone to the fifth edition of the Steptoe Cybersecurity and Privacy Podcast. I'm Michael Vadas in the Steptoe New York office, specializing in data privacy and cybersecurity and also civil litigation. With me in Washington, D.C. is my colleague Jason Weinstein, who's also concentrating on cybersecurity and privacy as well as white-collar criminal matters. And joining us later after our news roundup is esteemed Washington Post national security reporter Ellen Nakashima. She's going to give us a chance to turn the tables on her and ask her the tough probing questions that she normally asks us and lots of other people, including senior intelligence and law enforcement officials in the U.S. government. So let's start right in with a roundup of recent cybersecurity and privacy news. First item is that Attorney General Eric Holder last week said that the U.S. was willing to discuss how a criminal case against Edward Snowden would proceed, but only if Snowden pleaded guilty first. And some of the media has played this as some sort of the beginning of some sort of concession, but I don't know, Jason, you've handled plea bargaining before, and this seems not even to be plea bargaining. It's kind of plead guilty before there's any bargaining.
Yeah, in fact, what struck me about this is it seems designed to send the message that Snowden's going to be treated the same way any other criminal defendant would be treated. The fact is, any person who was essentially a fugitive, which is what he is, a person who's charged who has fled the jurisdiction to avoid arrest is a fugitive legally. And any fugitive who tried to work out some sort of deal with the government, whether it's with the attorney general or with a first-year assistant U.S. attorney, would be told the same thing, which is you have to turn yourself in and deal with your criminal charges, and then we'll talk. So I think that what the attorney general is saying is completely consistent with that, and also seems to be designed to slam the door on any notion of clemency as well.
Right, but in a normal plea bargain, if you're not dealing with a fugitive, I mean, the defendant's not going to plead guilty unless he has some sense of what he's facing, right? I mean, otherwise, what's his incentive?
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, at least Snowden knows that he's been told, because the Attorney General has said this publicly, that the government will not seek the death penalty, even if at some point he's charged with an offense for which the death penalty is an available punishment. And he knows that based on what he's charged now, he faces a statutory maximum of 10 years on each of the three counts, so that could be 10 total if he was convicted on all three and they were imposed concurrently, and it could be 30 if they're imposed consecutively. What he doesn't know is what the government's actual position would be as to the appropriate sentence. And that's something that, you know, most defendants who are entering into a plea bargain at least have some sense of how the government believes the guidelines apply to that person before they make a decision. You know, the goal obviously being to help the defendant make an informed decision about whether a guilty plea is in his interest. And here that discussion hasn't taken place. But I think what the Attorney General is trying to say is we're not going to have that discussion until you turn yourself in.
Right. So not really, not the beginning of any sort of concession or talk of clemency. In related news, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont called for the end of the Section 215 program, repeating some of the recommendations and analysis of the President's Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which called for an end to the program, said it was unconstitutional and really not consistent with the language of Section 215. There was also an open letter signed by a pretty broad array of cybersecurity researchers in academia and the private sector, which was interesting because it really focused more on the cybersecurity implications of the 215 program, rather than the privacy concerns. I mean, they mentioned privacy, but it's really more about the worries that having massive amounts of data in one place poses the risk of cybersecurity if a hacker or a foreign government is able to access that same data. I thought that was interesting, but I don't know, it still seems to me that we're unlikely to see standalone legislation to repeal Section 215, and the real question is whether Congress is going to refuse to extend the program when it sunsets next year without substantial changes. Let's go to the next item for you, Jason. Tell us about this case about Google pushing back now against the possibility of data localization pushed by countries like Brazil.
So one of the consequences of the Snowden leaks, I think, is that they've given momentum to efforts in some countries, and Brazil is probably the most prominent one, to adopt laws requiring local storage of their citizens' data within their own borders, and that's what people often refer to as data localization. Officially, the proponents of these laws suggest that their goal is to keep their citizens' data from access by the U.S. government. I think upon closer inspection, I suggest that the real goal is somewhat more cynical, and that is to make their own data more accessible to their citizens' data more accessible to their own governments. Under the mutual legal assistance process that governs the U.S. relationship with most countries, for a country to get content that's stored in the United States for use in one of their own investigations, they have to meet U.S. legal standards. They've got to satisfy a U.S. judge that they have enough evidence to satisfy the probable cause standard or whatever other standard applies to the data they're seeking. And it's often the case that no matter how earnestly they want that data, they can't get it because, or at least they can't get it without some additional effort because they don't have enough evidence to meet our standards. So I think the issue is both a legal one and a significant economic one. It's a legal one because, there are often legitimate investigations in foreign countries where they would like to have access to data that happens to be stored in the U.S., and they like to have a reliable and consistent process for getting that data that doesn't take an overly long period of time. And it's a frequent complaint by other countries about the MLAT process that it takes too long and it's too cumbersome. But it's an economic issue, too. According to – there are a number of studies that try to project how much income U.S. cloud providers are at risk of losing because of foreign concerns about U.S. government access to data. One study puts that number at about $180 billion of business that U.S. providers would lose to foreign providers who claim, I would suggest falsely, that their customers' data is more secure from government access if it's held by a foreign provider than a U.S. provider. And Google has argued that this kind of data localization movement will create what they call a splinter net that will result in a series of smaller national or regional internets instead of the global internet we have now, and that it will make it difficult and in some cases economically just not feasible for providers to serve some markets, including some fairly large markets. So I think the country's got an economic incentive to deal with this, and in terms of the legal issues, I think it highlights the need for reform of the MLAT process. As you know, Mike, the President's Advisory Group on Surveillance Reforms actually specifically mentioned reform of the MLAT process as a priority, and the President made reference to it in his speech at the Justice Department a few weeks ago. The Office of International Affairs, which is the office at the Justice Department's criminal division that handles these requests and deals with the foreign governments, has been trying for a few years now to be creative about the ways it can improve the process within the limited resources that it has. But there's a real need to build on those steps. And unfortunately, that office has been badly understaffed and under-resourced for years and years and years. And the administration, if it's serious about this, needs to not just talk about MLAT reform, but needs to work with OIA, as the office is called, to figure out ways to expand on the creative measures they've already implemented, but also make a substantial investment of resources. Because making foreign countries satisfied that the MLAT process is consistent and reliable and efficient, I think will go a long way toward blunting momentum for some of these data localization laws.
What do you think about reports that Microsoft is seeing these localization efforts as a business opportunity? In that, they're saying, hey, if you want to store your data locally, we're happy to do that, as long as you continue to use us or come to us as your cloud provider. Seems to me to undercut the force of Google's argument about these laws turning the internet into a splinter net.
Yeah, I think there's real tension there, and I don't know who's right, and it may be that there's merit to both positions, but I'm surprised that I'm never surprised when Google and Microsoft take different views on things, but I'm surprised that they've taken a different view on this particular issue.
It's interesting, too, because it was a speech by a Microsoft official last year or the year before in which he acknowledged that the U.S. is able to access data stored abroad if it's held by a U.S. company or the affiliate of a U.S. company. Which led to a big marketing campaign by European cloud providers saying,
hey, don't store your data with a U.S.-owned cloud provider because it's not secure from the prying eyes of NSA or the FBI. And now Microsoft is saying, you know, despite that acknowledgement, it's saying, hey, store with us. We're happy to store it locally without acknowledging what they said a couple of years ago.
That's right. That's right.
Well, let's move to another item. The administration announced last week that it would be willing now to allow communications providers to be more transparent about the sorts of demands that they receive from law enforcement and intelligence agencies. This was something that the NSA review group recommended. It's also something that the providers have been pushing for because they want to be able to show their subscribers, customers, users, what sorts of demands they receive and what sorts of information they reveal. So the bottom line is that for the first time now, providers will be able to reveal information about how many orders they're receiving under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, for both the content of communications, customer selectors targeted by FISA orders, meaning the names of someone, email address, an IP address, and also FISA orders for non-content information. You know, who sent whom an email, when was it sent, from where was it sent, et cetera. They still are limited. If they're going to report the FISA number separately from other demands, such as national security letters, they've got to report them only in bands of 1,000. So if a company, for instance, received 569 FISA orders, they can only report that they received somewhere between 0 and 999. And the same thing with NFLs, et cetera. Alternatively, they can report all of the types of orders in the aggregate, criminal orders, FISA orders. I'm sorry, not criminal orders. They can report those separately, but FISA orders and NFL and any other national security process that they receive. And if they lump them all together, then they can report them in bands of 250. So, you know, either way, there's not a heck of a lot of transparency, but it's more than they were allowed in the past. Because of this new rule being issued by jointly by the AG and the Director of National Intelligence, some of the providers dropped a suit that they had brought in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of all places, saying that this was sufficient to get them to drop the suit, but that they're still going to push for more transparency by backing legislation that would allow them to report the more granular information about the types of orders they received, how many accounts are affected, and the like.
Michael,
let's move on to from NSA matters to our favorite cybersecurity and privacy regulator, the Federal Trade Commission. There was something last week about the LabMD case. Jason, want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so the FTC had yet another big week in data privacy and data security. As we've written about on the blog before, that's steptocyberblog.com, the FTC filed an administrative complaint against LabMD back in 2013, and the allegation was that the company failed to implement reasonable security practices, and it was based on two incidents that affected personal data of about 10,000 customers. LabMD is actually one of only two companies, Wyndham Hotels being the other one, that has decided to challenge the FTC's authority to regulate private companies' data security practices as unfair or deceptive trade practices under Section 5 of the FTC Act. Every other company that the FTC has come after for failing to adopt reasonable security measures has settled with the FTC. Wyndham Hotels' case is proceeding in federal court in New Jersey, and LabMD's case is proceeding through administrative processes. In fact, LabMD has made statements recently suggesting that the cost of pursuing this litigation with the FTC is putting its very survival at risk. But what was decided last week was a motion to dismiss that LabMD filed with the FTC, arguing that the FTC lacked authority to regulate in this area. And shockingly, the FTC disagreed. The FTC concluded that its enacting statute gave it the authority under Section 5 to go after the failure to implement reasonable and appropriate data security measures. The FTC rejected the argument that it's not legally permitted to act without first promulgating regulations that make clear what reasonable security measures are. You know, the immediate effect of the case is that it will proceed in litigation. It'll proceed to a hearing before an administrative law judge, which I think is scheduled for May of this year. The broader issue of the FTC's authority remains out there. The Wyndham litigation is still going on. Although whatever the outcome in that case is, I think we can expect the FTC's role that it's assumed for itself as America's de facto data protection authority to remain intact. In fact, just last week on Friday, the FTC announced the 50th settlement since it began this campaign of data security and privacy enforcement. That settlement was against a company called GMR Transcription Services, which provided audio transcription services for healthcare providers and hospitals and academics and government agencies, among others. And the FTC alleged that that company, GMR, had files that it transmitted in the clear over the Internet, not secured by anything, and that they also had files that were accessible by their contractors without any authentication whatsoever, so they were publicly accessible through a search engine. And they also said that GMR failed to monitor the security practices of one of its service providers. And as a result of that, GMR had to agree to the traditional FTC settlement, which includes data protection audits for every other year for a 20-year period, among other improvements. So I think, you know, the interesting that the FTC's 50th settlement, which it made a big deal of announcing, came the same week that it denied LabMD's motion to dismiss. And I think that for a number of reasons, we can expect the FTC not to give any ground in this space and not to get any less active. As we talked about before, a strong FTC, or the perception of a strong FTC, is actually helpful to U.S. efforts to preserve the safe harbor, and more generally to battle the perception in Europe that the U.S. is weak on privacy enforcement. And I think in the wake of Target and other breaches, which we've talked about before and we'll talk about a little later in the podcast, there's a renewed call for legislation to set data security standards and to make clear the FTC's authority in this space. So I think that the FTC is not going anywhere, and it will only look to, you know, start collecting its next 50 scalps as we move forward.
Well, I get to report on the world's longest lasting Nazi sex orgy. I guess it's not the orgy itself that's lasted so long, but it's the resulting legal aftermath. This involves a sex party with prostitutes held and paid for by Max Mosley, who is the former head of the governing body of Formula One Racing. Apparently, there was a video made and also still pictures resulting from the video of the orgy, in which prostitutes were dressed in Nazi-themed attire. He sued, I think it was News of the World that published the pictures, but he's also sought to get Google to block search results because these pictures are, you know, still available on the Internet. And Google has been willing to remove the pictures when it's alerted to them, but it's opposed efforts to try to make it filter out the images as soon as they're posted without being told about them. And a couple of months ago, a French court ordered Google to filter out search results for those pictures. And 2 weeks ago, a German court ordered essentially the same thing, ordered Google to block the search results in Germany that linked to photos from this sex party. Google's already said it's going to appeal, but, you know, this is an issue that Google has faced probably as long as its search engine has existed, with people usually over privacy grounds seeking to block access to search results that they say infringe on its privacy. And, you know, this is supposed to be something that EU law, like U.S. law, prevents. That is, it allows search engines to host third-party content and to show search results for third-party content. But that hasn't prevented courts from occasionally saying that Google still has to block those search results. It's going to be interesting. Google said it will appeal, and once we get to a higher court, we may get a different result. Let's go to our final item before our discussion with Ellen. That's our
seems like our weekly data breach update, since pretty much on a weekly basis, there's a major new development in the breach arena.
So I think since our last podcast, there's been yet another major breach or developments in another major breach announced, and that is involving Michaels stores. For those keeping score at home, since just before Christmas, there have been major breaches announced involving Target, Neiman Marcus, and Michaels. Michaels actually announced last week that it was investigating a possible security attack involving payment card information. But even though the attack had not been confirmed, they took the step of making the announcement in advance to help customers, to make customers more alert to the possibility of misuse of their credit cards. And now, even though I think to this date, Michaels still has not officially announced or confirmed the breach, they're already facing at least one lawsuit. Neiman Marcus is already in litigation, and Target, as we've talked about before, seems to be facing new lawsuits every day. I think the current total is somewhere between 50 and 70 lawsuits, both consumer lawsuits and lawsuits with banks. Michaels, interestingly, had a breach issue, although it may or may not be the same type of breach, once before. Back in 2011, Michaels settled a class action involving unauthorized access to PIN pads at 90 of their stores. When I was at DOJ, we had a criminal case in the Northern District of California involving that same incident that resulted in guilty pleas by the folks responsible. And so Michaels is now facing the same sort of litigation nightmare that the Target is facing, although perhaps not on the same scale. And Target's litigation nightmare has expanded from consumer class actions to now class actions filed by financial institutions as well for losses that they have to cover for fraudulent transactions, plus the cost of canceling and reissuing cards. And there are multiple banks that have now brought suit against Target, including banks in New York, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Alabama, and other places as well. And some of those suits allege that Target had been warned about possible vulnerabilities by Visa back in 2013 and by a security researcher back in 2007. So I think that litigation and those allegations are probably going to make the seat that was already going to be hot a little bit hotter tomorrow when Target CFO testifies in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Attorney General confirmed at his appearance before the Senate last week that a criminal investigation is underway into the Target breach. That's not much of a shock. The FTC has not announced yet publicly that it's investigating Target, but I think it's a better bet than the Broncos would have been yesterday for the Super Bowl that the FTC is investigating. And of course, Target is dealing with all this litigation as well. Interestingly, and especially in light of what we just talked about with the GMR case, Target announced last week that hackers had accessed its system through one of its vendors, through security credentials that were stolen from one of its vendors. And while I think the forensic investigation is still ongoing and the facts are still developing, the same is true of this GMR case, that at least one of its security lapses that the FTC accused it of involved not being on top of what its vendor or service provider was doing with its data when on the service provider system. So I think Target, and especially when combined with this GMR case, they're both good reminders to people that it's not enough to be worried about your own systems. You also have to be worried about the systems of cloud providers and suppliers and vendors and other third parties that have access to your data and access to your network. So Target's problems continue. I'm sure by the time we do the podcast next week, there'll be even more litigation filed against all three of those companies. And it'll be interesting to see how the hearing goes tomorrow.
You mentioned Denver in the context of the Super Bowl, but that reminds me of a critical case filed last year, last week in Denver. It's actually one that Ellen reported on, the Mutaro case. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, but you want to tell us about that? It seems like it's the first challenge to the 702 program under FISA that may go somewhere.
Sure, and we could talk about this more with Ellen as well, but this is a Uzbekistan national who is, I think, a legal permanent resident of the United States, who was alleged to have provided material support to a group called the Islamic Jihad Union, which is a designated foreign terrorist organization. And the evidence against him reportedly includes email traffic that he sent to an email address that was identified as being associated with this group. And the Justice Department formally advised him, I think back in October, that some of the evidence against him in the case was derived from the what we now know as the PRISM program, which is the collection of content that was targeted at people reasonably believed to be outside the United States, pursuant to Section 702. There was a lawsuit, as you'll recall, last year or the year before, called Clapper versus ACLU, in which a group of journalists and lawyers and human rights activists challenged 702, and the Supreme Court held that they didn't have standing because they couldn't demonstrate any reasonable probability to believe that their communications had been intercepted. The Justice Department's acknowledgement to Muterov, or however you say his name, that his communications were intercepted pursuant to this program certainly eliminates standing as an obstacle for him. And so, as you said, this will be the first time in a criminal case where a judge will be asked to evaluate the constitutionality of the program, because essentially his argument is that the evidence that the criminal case is based on is either directly or indirectly derived from collection pursuant to Section 702.
It's interesting the way the government's notice to him happened, because in that Clapper case, as you mentioned, one of the arguments from the Solicitor General in that case was, you know, that the court should find that there was no standing, and it really didn't need to worry about the argument that, you know, if there's no standing here, then no one will ever be able to challenge the constitutionality of 702, because he said, look, the law requires us to notify defendants if evidence against them was derived from Section 702 surveillance. And then it turned out that, in fact, defendants were not being so advised by DOJ prosecutors. And when the SG found out about that, I would expect he wasn't very pleased, and sounds like he essentially forced a change in the government policy, in prosecutorial policy. And so at least Mutarov was notified, I think maybe one or two others. So it's interesting that, you know, the argument he made to the Supreme Court turned out not to be accurate. And I believe that argument was actually cited by the court in Clapper. So, you know, they probably weren't too happy to have relied on that assertion that turned out not to be correct.
That's right.
Well, let's move on now to our, really the best part of today's podcast, which is our discussion with Ellen Nakashima of the Washington Post. You know, it's been interesting following the reporting on Snowden in particular, because the Post has been right at the center of it. Ellen and her colleague, Bart Gellman, it's just, you know, it seems like we talk about, you know, how the FTC is so active in cybersecurity, and every week there's a new development. It seems like every week or 2 weeks there's a new development in the Snowden leak matter. And the Post is right in the thick of it, and therefore so is Ellen. So, Ellen, welcome to our podcast. You're a pioneer, only our fourth or fifth guest, I think, and we'd love to have you.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Ellen, let's start with what was announced last week, that Vice Admiral Mike Rogers is going to be the new director of the NSA and has been nominated to be the new head of the U.S. Cyber Command. Why do you think Admiral Rogers was chosen, and what do you expect the reaction to be on the Hill and in the intelligence community to that selection?
Well, it's interesting that Vice Admiral Rogers has been, in a sense, groomed, I think, for this position going back a number of years. He started out primarily as a cryptologist, or crippy, as they call it in the Navy, and as such was not an all-source or straight intelligence analyst, which is what many of the current and former NSA directors have been, like General Alexander, or in the past Mike Hayden and Admiral Inman. So it's really actually quite unusual that he is in this position today. But what happened was, I would say around 2005, 2006, he was serving on the joint staff as a executive assistant to then Chairman Peter Pace, who spotted sort of his talent, what I'm told, this ability to see and think strategically, and said, this guy has potential to become more than just, you know, being a captain in the Navy as a cryptologist, and sort of gave him a first big break to head up his they call it the CAG, the Chairman's Action Group. It's an in-house think tank. It's really an interesting body that sort of advises the chairman on big strategic, in-the-future, blue-sky, over-the-horizon type issues. And then from there, he did really well, and so they moved him up to become the Director of Intelligence for Pacific Command, which is another really big job, and in a way quite striking for someone who had never been an all-source intelligence analyst. And he did well there, and from there they moved him up to become the Director of Intelligence for the Joint Staff, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So he was in a great position to brief all the senior military leaders, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and through some of the most important campaigns of our time, to include Libya. He was key on that issue during our Libya, the bombing of Libya with NATO. And all through that time, I'm told, he was sort of being positioned for a possible eventual nomination to head the NSA. He was being kind of, his experience base was being broadened. He was proving himself. He was getting noticed. And for the last couple of years or so, I've been hearing his name as the probably likely successor to Keith Alexander at NSA. Then on top of that, he did well at the J-2 for Joint Staff. He was named to be the commander of 10th Fleet, Fleet Cyber Command, which is the Navy's cyber warfare, cybersecurity arm that works with and reports to U.S. Cyber Command and also handles cyber operations for the Navy, the service. And between the two jobs, he was really, I think, being positioned well to take over this very, I guess, consequential position now as head of NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, which is cyber warfare organization.
It's interesting. One of the things that struck me is that, you know, Admiral Rogers seems like the perfect choice to run the NSA in the pre-Snowden era.
Correct.
But after all the Snowden leaks, there's so much intense public focus on NSA and its intelligence collection that you wonder whether any military officer is the best choice to head NSA. And it's, you know, it's notable that the NSA review group recommended that the position be open to civilian heads. And I think they urged that the next head in particular be a civilian. Because it has seemed like some of the recent directors of NSA have gotten into a little bit of trouble when they describe NSA's, when they have described NSA's handling of privacy issues. You know, over the decades, have always given strong assurances that NSA respects privacy, follows the law, has all sorts of internal regulations to protect privacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, which are very general and kind of bland assertions, but they really haven't been able to engage, I think, legislators in particular, on the very specific privacy issues. So, well, I mean, what do you think about that? The Obama administration basically said, we're not going that way. We're going to leave this as a military position.
And in fact, you know, President Obama, came to that decision, on his own in a sense after a number of senior advisors and administration officials actually kind of recommended against it, recommended that they split the positions and install a civilian head at NSA. But I think Obama was swayed by the arguments of Keith Alexander and others whose counsel he sought, I think, on that issue, which is primarily that right now, in any way, Cyber Command depends so heavily on NSA for its, for the intelligence it gains, for the access to networks it needs, and it depends so heavily on NSA skills and accesses, really, that you need someone who is, you need them to be joined as closely as possible and someone who understands both equities really, really well. Because if you have them separate, then you could have a lot of tension between the two. The flip argument to that is, well, you do need to have a person who's a military guy at Cyber Command, and then maybe a separate either civilian or military intelligence officer at NSA to really argue out the respective needs and equities for the two organizations. But Obama himself decided that he should keep a military person in charge of NSA, keep the two positions under one man, and he interviewed Vice Admiral Rogers a few weeks ago personally, and personally signed off on him as the nominee to be the next NSA director. So I would imagine from that he must have gotten a sense that he thinks Rogers is up to the task, at least of trying to restore some trust and faith in the intelligence community and in NSA.
Maybe the other news from, I think it was last week too, that NSA was appointing its first chief privacy officer was at least in part an effort to assuage the critics who wanted a civilian head of NSA, because presumably now this chief privacy officer is going to be more public in defending NSA's privacy practices.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting artifacts of this whole Snowden, a series of Snowden leaks and revelations since last June, is just how much more public officials at NSA have become. They're testifying on the Hill and before the Privacy Civil Liberties Oversight Board and the President's Review Group. They're testifying publicly in ways they never did before, just so much more often. They're forced to be a little more candid and forthcoming than they otherwise, I think, would have been. It used to be the joke that being the public affairs officer at NSA was the easiest job in the world, because all you did was no comment, right? No comment. Now they have really, beefed up their staff. They have a whole sort of SWAT team of people who are on call pretty much 24/7, I guess, and they're handling a number of press inquiries, not just from here in the U.S., but all over the world.
How much of that is done by NSA, and how much is done by the Office of the DNI, which also has its own chief privacy officer?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I think that sometimes they coordinate and they'll decide this is a question for you at ODNI, or this is more technical, we'll let NSA handle it, or maybe a little more political, we'll punt it over to the White House National Security staff. It tends to be, I think, with the legal policy issues, statutory authority type questions, you get ODNI handling them, with a rare once in a while assist from public assist from justice. And then on the more technical questions, I think you see NSA being called on a little more.
Interesting.
So, Ellen, one of the things that I know you followed the prospects for cybersecurity legislation in the Congress, mm-hmm. And even before anyone ever heard of Snowden outside of the media family, the prospects for the legislation were challenging. Some people were opposed to it because they viewed it as imposing a system of regulation on businesses when cybersecurity standards should be voluntary and not mandatory. And there were others who were concerned about the potential privacy implications of having a requirement that companies share information with the government.
Mm-hmm.
In the aftermath of the Snowden leaks, mm-hmm. What do you think the prospects for that legislation are, and how do you think Snowden has affected them?
Well, if they were dim before, then I think they're pretty dark now, especially for any legislation that is comprehensive in nature, that tries to get at the issue of standards, mandatory standards in any way, information sharing, which is what you alluded to, having companies share back or turn over to the government indications of their threats or breaches they see in their networks, in exchange for, though I should say, a fairly blanket immunity against lawsuits for sharing that information. And all of those individual components are objectionable to some constituency, in Congress or in the community, business community, in industry, the privacy community. And now we're in 2014, a midterm election year, and it's sort of also common wisdom that you can't get comprehensive cybersecurity legislation in an election year. So safe. Add to that the aftermath of the Snowden leaks, in which the just overall trust in government has just diminished greatly. The idea of any private company turning over information to the government, NSA or even DHS, I think has becomes anathema to people. So I would say pretty slim prospect for this year.
Interesting to me, back on that NSA review group, the reality is that the president rejected a lot of their recommendations, or at least didn't announce the implementation of them. Some fairly significant and some fairly radical recommendations, such as preventing NSA, at least for the most part, from engaging in zero-day exploits, that is, taking advantage of vulnerabilities in software that hadn't previously been revealed. They would ban NSA from doing that, which seems to me would be a significant hindrance on NSA.
Right.
Barring NSA from engineering any vulnerabilities in security standards and such. Have you heard anything about what the reaction from the members of the review group has been? Are they really ticked off that their report wasn't implemented more thoroughly?
Right. They are, for the most part, pleased that some of their more, central and signature recommendations have been adopted in whole or in part. And by that I mean, for instance, the recommendation to transfer out of government hands the custodianship of the NSA's phone metadata collection. And so President Obama did embrace that and announce it. Problem or question there is, what's the solution or the alternative? And we don't know what that's going to be because the administration...
And ultimately it may not happen.
Ultimately it may not happen. Ultimately, as you said earlier, this could well, come down to June 2015 when the underlying statutory authority for this collection expires. And if the current political dynamic holds sway and we don't have another major terrorist attack, I think that consensus is that the current Congress, the House, would not renew the authority in its current form. So, anyway, that's one of the main recommendations, and they were pleased that he did embrace that. Another one was to require that the FISA court approve queries of that phone database in the meantime while the government still has it. And the president did embrace that in the end after some 11th-hour appeals from the group. But he did not, he said he did not embrace their recommendation to so-called split the hat, the dual hats of NSA and Cyber Command, and install a civilian director at NSA. He opted to go to stay with the status quo. And then he was silent on a number of other recommendations, which is, as you mentioned, not to harbor or store zero-day software tools, and not to undermine sort of encryption of the network. Those are some very important recommendations for some scientists, privacy community activists, technologists who fear that without such protections, the ultimate overall security of the networks will be undermined. And their contention is that NSA can continue to do what it needs to do to include cyber attacks on adversaries if it needs to, even if it doesn't, store up all these 0 days. I don't know whether I'm not an expert enough on that to know if it's true.
And I suppose he's not going to talk publicly about that, whatever he does.
I would imagine not, yeah. I think the review group is waiting for a more of a readout from the White House on where the White House has come down on some of these other recommendations. There were 46 of them, so maybe they haven't finished going through all of them and deciding what they want to do on each single one.
Since the Snowden leaks have started, we've heard a lot from intelligence officials in particular about the damage that the leaks have caused.
damage in terms of lost sources and methods because terrorists and other foreign adversaries have changed their communication methods to avoid surveillance. Talk of diplomatic harm, and you know, there hasn't been any specificity really to those claims of harm. We've certainly seen Angela Merkel complaining repeatedly about violation of privacy and Brazilian politicians. But beyond that, you know, do you have any sense of what harm genuinely has occurred and what that harm might be, either diplomatically or in terms of intelligence or anything else?
I mean, no. In terms of intelligence loss, no. The intelligence community has not been more, you know, given more details than what you just said about having noticed that Al-Qaeda affiliated groups have changed methods of communications, and so they've gone dark on some of these sources they used to have. However, some intelligence officials also note that sort of if there is a silver lining to this, technology continues to evolve, and as technology evolves, so everyone, including militants and terrorists, will shift with that, and the NSA will eventually adapt to these technological changes. So it may be a loss today, but you know, perhaps 6 months, a year, or 2 years down the line, NSA will have recouped some of that intelligence. On the diplomatic level, you know, I think there's a difference between what politicians like Angela Merkel say publicly and then what her intelligence services say and do privately. My sense is that the intelligence agency working level, operational level, the relationships are still fairly solid, continue to be so because, after all, Germany and France, we all very much depend on U.S. intelligence for a lot of their good information.
So you don't think there, or at least you haven't heard, that there's been any really disruption of relationship at the working level, with any countries, as far as you know?
As far as I know, right, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. But I do think, you know, at the sort of broader public perception level, there is definitely a sense that the United States needs to really step up to the plate and do more to reassure the world community that it is taking their concerns seriously, their citizens' privacy seriously, and it's going to do more to make sure that they prove it, you know, not just say things.
Mm-hmm. You heard any rumors about any other upcoming changes in leadership of intelligence agencies or other parts of the government, maybe stemming from the Snowden leaks beyond the appointment of Mike Rogers and Ted Hamilton?
None that I've heard that I would pass on here, but if you have, please do share them with me. You know, you always hear, like, you know, how many times have we heard that Eric Holder's days were numbered and then he seems to come back, right? And I've heard rumors about Clapper going back 5 years now, 4 years, so.
Well, I read last week that Daryl Issa has decided it's his mission to get Clapper fired, so that may only help ensure that Clapper gets to stay around a little bit longer. So, Ellen, shifting gears from Snowden's impact on the intelligence community and on diplomacy to potential impact on law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
We talked in the roundup about the Muradov case in Colorado. At least I'm deciding for now that's how his name is pronounced, in which the constitutionality of Section 702 in prison will be challenged. And there was reporting last year about a bank robbery case involving a defendant named Terrence Brown in South Florida, where he viewed cell phone location data to be critical to his defense, and that location data wasn't available. And so he filed a motion to get the government to turn over cell phone metadata collected by the NSA pursuant to Section 215, because he argued it was central to his defense. And turns out that the data collected by 215 was telephone connection metadata, not location data, so it wasn't relevant. But the judge did order the government to turn it over, which was somewhat extraordinary. And as you know, the law enforcement communities had some legislative priorities as well. dealing with the ability to conduct wiretaps and dealing with access to information under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. So what do you think, big picture, what do you think the Snowden leaks will do to law enforcement's legislative priorities, and do you think we'll see more of an impact in criminal cases like you see in Muderoff and in this Terrence Brown case?
Well, so Muderoff, I think, is the second criminal defendant to be notified by DOJ that evidence derived from Section 702 was used. And to date, I think Fasali Mualin in San Diego is the only case where the government has publicly acknowledged having used Section 215, the NSA telephone metadata, in that case. I don't know whether, you know, how many more there will have coming, but I imagine that the defense lawyers have really been emboldened to press hard now in every case to try to find out whether or not any FISA type of evidence has been used, especially from some of the special surveillance programs like 702 and 215. For me, the significance to the Muderoff or Mutarov case is that now, you know, maybe we will see a court finally judge or weigh in on the constitutionality of the program, which, as you noted, the Supreme Court didn't reach, other courts haven't reached because of the standing issue. That's one way in which I think the Snowden disclosures, if even indirectly, have had a significant impact. Because I'm not saying that the Snowden leaks prompted the Justice Department to notify, but it's part of that overall atmosphere in which I think when the Solicitor General learned that Justice Department had this policy of not notifying defendants when 702-derived evidence was being used, he was taken aback, angered probably even, because he had assured the Supreme Court that this was going on. And at the same time, this was in the thick of all of these sort of disclosures coming out about the PRISM and 215, and there was just this general sense that the government, you know, hey, we're supposed to be abiding by the rule of law. So I think the Solicitor General really felt strongly that it needed to abide by what is a statutory requirement, that you notify defendants when you use evidence derived from FISA. I think what impact could that have on law enforcement? Not sure exactly.
Well, yeah, I think the broader impact, I mean, the Muderoff case and the case you mentioned in San Diego, the impact of those will be measured somewhat by the number of defendants who have been subject to collection or whose evidence is derived from collection. Terrence Brown, I think, has some real potential legs because, you know, as you know, when it comes to discovery, which is a challenging area for federal prosecutors now throughout the country, prosecutors have generally been held responsible for what the government has, and what the government has generally been defined as what the law enforcement agencies and the prosecutor's office have, not what any other part of the U.S. government has. And when the government brings cases in which they believe that classified information might be relevant, that some intelligence agency might have information of a classified nature relating to a defendant, they'll often do what's called a prudential search to get to find out if the CIA or some other agency has data that might be discoverable related to the defendant. And I wonder if Terrence Brown...
chilling effect on bringing these cases into the criminal realm?
Sure. Well, the thing that makes Terrence Brown so potentially significant to me is that it is a classically criminal case. It's a bank robbery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a case where a prosecutor would have any reason to think that there's potentially classified information relating to a bank robbery defendant in South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're doing a case where the CIA has been involved overseas defendants or evidence collected overseas, there might be a reason to suspect, based on the nature of the crime or the location, that an intelligence agency might have information. But a line prosecutor in a bank robbery case in South Florida is not going to have any reason to think that. But I wonder if now there's going to be greater effort by defense lawyers to try to pierce the wall between the law enforcement side of the government and the intelligence community. And even in run-of-the-mill criminal cases, to force prosecutors to go find out what the intelligence community may have gathered about their
I do think so. I think that, why not, right? If you're a defense attorney, you want to try to pull out, use every tool at your disposal. And now it seems like maybe judges are a little more amenable to hearing these sorts of requests. The other interesting case in this regard is the Adel Daoud case in Chicago, where was it last week again, a judge, for the first time ever, I think, since FISA was first passed in 1978, ordered the Justice Department to let the cleared defense lawyer for Daoud have access to the evidence or affidavit material derived from FISA. To my knowledge, it's unprecedented. It's the first time ever, and I bet it sent shockwaves through DOJ on that. And what you can, when you play it out, there are certain, you know, there's some interesting implications. One is, of course, this, from the defendant's point of view, it's positive, right? Any evidence that's potentially disculpatory might be brought out. The judge had mentioned that in cases like this, you really can't have a truly adversarial process unless the defense lawyer is, you know, as informed as he or she can be about the client's case. So, in one sense, that's why she agreed to this order. Another potential implication, though, is that if the Justice Department and other agencies it works with sees that, well, these defense lawyers are going to get access to all this information that we're bringing in the national security context, maybe we don't want to bring the investigation into the criminal realm. Maybe we'll keep it, you know, strictly in the NatSec intelligence world to prevent it from coming out. I don't know, but that's one, you know, possible implication of all of this. It will be interesting to see where this all goes.
Do we know how the Justice Department is defining derived, you know, the term derived,
right,
in the context of 702? Because in the old days, something gathered from the intelligence side would be used as a lead. You know, basically, prosecutors and criminal investigators would be told, look, you know, this guy's up to no good, or, you know, they might even be more specific about intel they'd have. But then the criminal side, they would use, you know, Title III wiretap order to get information about the criminal activity of this person. Or they might even use a traditional FISA, you know, based on probable cause that the person is an agent of a foreign power. Is that, in the 702 context, is the government now saying that they'll notify a defendant anytime he was the subject of 702 surveillance?
Obtained or derived. I believe it is obtained or derived, so that even if the 702 evidence was used as the basis to obtain the traditional FISA, they would notify.
They'll still notify?
Yeah. That's my understanding.
So that's in itself is significant, I think, because it's a broader scope of information they'll give than they did in the past when it was sharing from intel to law enforcement.
Yeah, exactly right, because I think their policy in the past was to notify, you know, if it was maybe obtained from, you know, if the evidence was obtained from but not derived from. And so that's why the Mataro case is really significant.
So, you know, how does this all affect you personally? Has there been a change in your life as a national security reporter because of the Snowden leaks, the Manning leaks, you know, or is it just so much more to report on?
Yeah, it certainly has made me accumulate a huge sleep deficit, but at the same time, there's a lot more to report on, and it's so rich. It's challenging, but it's also very exciting in a way, because we are now, you know, debating very important issues in a depth that we never were able to do before. You know, the fact that for years we've been hearing Senator Ron Wyden warn about some privacy, you know, significant privacy issue with Section 215, but he was never able to spell it out. And then last June, Ed Snowden leaked the court order to The Guardian, and Guardian printed it. And when I first saw it, I said, if this is what I think it is, this is huge, and this story will have legs. And it turned out to be, in fact, one of the most consequential stories of the year, I think, because it's still playing out. It's not just the actual document itself, but it's all the spin-off, right? It's the way in which, I think in a sense, Snowden has served as a catalyst for many different actors to become more engaged, whether it's in the Justice Department, even the executive branch, the privacy community, technology companies, U.S. allies, in Europe, and just other officials. We're seeing just a lot more churn, and all of which I think is good. It's not to say that this is going to be the way it is forever. I think you've probably already noticed the pace of some of these, the documents and the stories that are based on documents has slowed a bit. For the first few months, it seemed like every week there was some big story. Now it's taking the reporters who have the documents more time to assemble a story by, you glean a piece of information from one document and then maybe from another, you put it together, you try to understand what it means, you need to do the legwork and reporting to really come up with a good story that advances the debate or is relevant to privacy, domestic privacy concerns and surveillance and security. And so in that sense, I think we will still have a very active year ahead, just following, at this point, the ball is in a sense in not just the administration's court, but in Congress's court, see how they handle some of this. But I do think you're right. We probably won't see any standalone legislation to repeal 215, but there are other issues, right? Like, how do we set up this public advocate for the FISA court along the lines of what President Obama said he wanted, which was sort of, I guess, a pool of advocates that could be chosen, and not exactly what the review group wanted, which was an independent or standalone advocate who could decide when he or she wanted to intervene in a case. But we're sort of seeing a lot of these back and forth debates playing out now, which is all good.
Now, on the reporting side, it's interesting because Snowden has said now he's got no more records himself. He's given them all to a variety of publications and reporters. And how does that affect the reporting? Is there more of a sense of competition and urgency that the Post doesn't want to get scooped by the Guardian or by Der Spiegel or someone else who might have Snowden documents, or is there collaboration going on still the way there was in the early days?
With WikiLeaks? Well, certainly early on, I think the sense of competition was highest because there were just a number of sort of key documents that I think, my colleague Bart had, and he maybe knew or suspected that Glenn Greenwald had and wanted to make sure we got the story out first and best. But after a while, that sort of lessened, in part because my sense is I don't know for sure because I don't have the documents personally and I don't even know what the full universe of documents is. But my sense is that some of the different reporters have different sets of documents. For instance, I think the New York Times has publicly stated, right, that they have a lot of documents relating to GCHQ, Britain's intelligence service, equivalent of NSA. So I think that's where their focus has been. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Was there anything that we haven't asked you that we should have?
No, I think you've covered the waterfront there pretty well.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and more importantly, to speak to our audience. This has really been eye-opening and informative for us and fun.
As for me. Thank you so much.
All right. With that, we look forward to speaking to everyone next week with our sixth edition of Steptoe Podcast.